is the Florida Spectacular Podcast with your hosts, Kathy Silustri and Rick Kilby. Keep up with Kathy at greatfloridaroadtrip.com and on Twitter and Instagram at Kathy Silustri. Find Rick at rickkilby.com. Now, discover a Florida you never knew existed.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to this week's episode of Florida Spectacular. How are you, Rick?
I'm right in the middle of trying to get my book done for my grant project. And so it's crunch time. My goal is to try and I'm self-publishing, get it out next week. So I'm taking the edits, dumping it into the layout, tweaking the layout, and sending it to the copy editor as fast as I can. So now that whole process that usually takes 18 months with UPF has, you know, I started this in November. So I'm hoping to have it in hand at the beginning of May.
If you have a competent editor, I don't see why you wouldn't self-publish. And you got a grant to work on this, right?
Yeah.
Can you tell us what it is?
So the grant is about the historic murals of Winter Park. So what I've basically done, you know, I don't have a word count or anything to restrain me. It's fallen down the rabbit hole with each of these murals and found all the contextual information, gone wherever the rabbit hole would lead me. So, you know, there's one at Rollins. So I talk about kind of the dynamics at Rollins College in 1945 that brought this about, which I thought was interesting. There's one in a private home. And I talked about how during the Florida land boom, Winter Park was called the City of Homes and kind of embraced this whole boom time mentality. And then kept it going even through the Depression. And then a lot of them have to do with the historically black neighborhood, or two of the murals have to do with the historically black neighborhood of Winter Park called Hannibal Square. So I talk about the gentrification that has occurred in Hannibal Square and some of the pioneers who have kept the history alive and started some of the institutions in the black community of Winter Park. So it's taken me places I didn't ever expect to go. And the other thing is artists. There's one of the artists why I was over in Tampa was Joe Testaseca, who has done a number of murals at USF, which is a good segue, actually. Mm-hmm. There's one at the administration building and one on the – I think it's called the Chemistry Auditorium. They were very early in the 1960s when, you know, USF had just a handful of buildings. And they're still in great shape. And he did a mural on the Winter Park Post Office, which is probably the most endangered one of the murals that I talk about.
Why endangered?
So many reasons. One, it's in bad need of restoration. And the situation with the Federal Post Office right now prevents it from being such because the post office is trying to just keep the doors open and the lights on in the current situation we have with the federal government, and they don't want to mess with it, restoring a mural right now. The other thing is it's right next to Central Park and Park Avenue, and the city constantly is wanting to expand green space. And so several times in the history of this mural, they've considered not rebuilding a new post office, knocking this one down, and with it, perhaps the mural. The same artist did a mural that's in Tampa on the post office in Ybor City, and they built a whole new – I'm sorry, on the library in Ybor City. They built a whole new library and took the mural off, you know, with – you know, they cemented it together, took it off, and then put it back on the new building.
Cool.
So – anyways, thanks for letting me talk.
Yeah. I confess I've been at USF for 25 years. I've never seen those murals on campus. But if it's not in Cooper Hall, then, I mean, that's my little hideout, and I don't get to many other parts of campus. So
that voice you're hearing is our guest for today, John Fleming, who, as you may have guessed, works at USF Tampa. And before we intro you, John, I want to thank you, Rick, for giving me a chance to shovel food into my face and eat my very belated breakfast.
I was running interference. That whole thing was really not about my grant. It was running interference.
No, it was fascinating, but I have this beautiful – I'm running, you know, I wake up and I do things and I think I have more time than I do. And so I thank God we're not a video podcast. I don't know what happens if we go video. You'll all get to see me with wet hair eating eggs. It's wonderful. The t-shirt for this week.
I do like your green glasses, though, and it's a shame nobody is seeing those.
They're
Look at that.
Yeah. You have like all the different colors to put
on? I only have two colors and sunglasses. I need to get more. So,
nice.
So for everybody listening, if you're wondering what the hell they're talking about, I have these really cool glasses called Pair, and you buy the glasses and then you get magnetized frames. So yeah, but anyway, they're not sponsoring the podcast. Screw them. I want to talk about John Fleming and his book, The Wonders of Shadow Key, which, excuse me, if you're not listening to this as it drops, we taped it in April 2026. And what was the release date of your book, John?
Yesterday.
March 31st. So this is day one.
Day one, and you're already on the best podcast in Florida.
Yeah. What more could I ask for?
I mean, for everybody listening to buy your book, The Wonders of Shadow Key. So it's a great book. I read it months ago. I know the newspaper that I own is running my review of it, or has run the review of it, I believe,
yes,
already.
Thank you.
Well, I just turn it into the editor. I have no control over that. I'm like, okay, this is when the book publishes. So, and then it shows up and I've forgotten about it. So, but I really enjoyed the book. It was, I would almost call it dystopian YA fiction. Dystopian YA cli-fi. Is that a genre?
Yeah, it is.
And it's dystopian cli-fi redundant.
Maybe so.
Well, you're the professor. If you don't know, I don't know.
What is cli-fi?
Climate fiction.
Oh.
Specifically, I think climate change fiction. And it's like, what was it called? The Light Thief? The Light Pirate. It was beautifully written. Yeah, I live on the Gulf Coast, and I read it the month after both those hurricanes came through in 2024. I really could have used better judgment with that.
Yeah.
But your book your book deals with... middle grades, middle school?
Yes.
Uh-huh. A middle school girl whose parents have taken her on vacation to a hotel that's basically, I don't even know how to describe it. It was an area decimated by hurricanes, and I guess her parents, this was the only place they could take her on vacation.
The backdrop is, so this is near future Florida, when those... That trend of hurricanes that we got fall before last has expanded, continued, and they get hurricanes almost every week, almost throughout the year. So, as you can imagine, it causes all kinds of disruptions, the kind of pandemic sort of disruptions we were used to some years ago. And school gets canceled, buildings get destroyed, houses get destroyed, people start leaving the state. The main character, Eleanor, a lot of her friends have moved to the mountains, which we know from that season are not safe either. And her parents have lost their jobs because of hurricane issues. And creditors are knocking on the door. Eleanor calls them the door knockers because her parents are very secretive about it. People knock on the door and they all have to be quiet and hide out. So they want to get out of there to escape the door knockers and find some relief. And her dad locates a very cheap, unsurprisingly, beach condo at a little town that's been abandoned on the beach but is not completely destroyed. So they go there and they stay in an old condo called the Shadow Key Inn. And that's kind of the setup. She thinks it's the most ridiculous idea for a vacation because they tell her it's going to be a vacation and she doesn't believe them. And but it turns out great for her because she makes friends there and the friends happen to be ghosts that only she can see.
Those are the best ghosts. I don't want to share ghosts.
It's awesome. That's one thing I wasn't clear because there's perpetually storms brewing up. So those are actual hurricanes. So we get to the point in your book where we don't even name the hurricanes and not, like nobody prepares. They're just here.
There's so many hurricanes, and they stopped the naming cycle for hurricanes. But her dad keeps calling them, you know, making up names for them. Like there was Norm followed by Norma. And those two were like the double whammy on their town. And then there are storms that aren't hurricanes, just really strong storms. And people just don't even make that dividing line anymore. Like every storm could be a hurricane and could come at any point.
Fair. Let's go back to the ghosts. Because the rest is depressing. But the ghosts are cheerful. It had kind of a, when I was reading the scenes with the ghosts, because, okay, I'm assuming a lot of people haven't read the book, but Rick and I have. And I guess you're familiar with it, John. So
a little bit.
As I was reading the book, and the ghosts have their own hotel room, which I think is cool.
They have their own floor.
Well, yeah.
So it's like a two-story, it's like a converted motel. Well, two-story motel, beach motel. It was called the Shadow Key Inn, was converted to condos. And because of flooding, nobody goes to the bottom floor anymore anyway. So they got a cheap condo on the second floor. But the first floor, it turns out, is inhabited entirely by ghosts.
And the vibe they give off, even though the ghosts appear to be from different points in time, the vibe that they give off very much gave me like 1950s roadside Florida vibe. Was that intentional or did I just want that to be the thing?
That's definitely intentional, especially with the ghost that Eleanor befriends first, Mabel. Mabel Frobisher. She's like a 1950s Florida beach lady. She wears cat eye sunglasses. She walks around with a drink with an umbrella in it. And sundresses, flowered sundresses. And she sits outside of her motel room in a beach chair all day. And she doesn't think any of the humans, living humans, excuse me, any of the living humans can see her. And it turns out Eleanor can, and she's shocked. And she, because the ghosts are having a problem with sea monsters trying to get them, sea monsters who live just offshore, she thinks, well, Eleanor, maybe she can help save us. And so she's like the main ghost friend. But then there are others that are not from 1950s Florida. There's a like an old pirate captain who's not sure that he's dead. He has to be convinced. He keeps waiting for his pirate ship to come and pick him up. There is a Spanish family. Probably from the 19th century, early 20th century that washed up there. They have two kids. One of them was not born yet when the family died. So his face is, sort of blank, not filled in.
I didn't quite understand that.
Okay. And then, there is a actor singer, who is, probably from, I don't know, she might also be from the 19th century. She's used to performing on stages around the world. And so she is very sort of, used to high culture and doesn't associate with the others quite as much. But she also falls in love with the captain, the pirate captain. And then there's another character called the Nameless Mute Gentleman, who is sort of half there and half not. He fizzles out. He kind of goes back off into the other world that they can't have access to. So he's got one foot in this ghost world and one foot somewhere else, and they don't know where he goes. And then finally, like the core of the whole group are the fabulous singing Siren Sisters. So they are reformed sirens. They got tired of luring ships to their demise on the rocks, and they decided to break from that and just hang out on this little island with the other ghosts and sing. And it's their singing, which is so powerful, that helps keep the monsters away.
That's a good use for mermaids.
Have we not? That's not a spoiler. I mean, are we doing a spoiler? Should we give a spoiler alert?
Yeah, I don't think that's a spoiler.
Okay,
I mean, that's part of the setup. We know.
Okay.
I mean, Eleanor doesn't know that they're ghosts right away, so I guess that is kind of a spoiler. But she finds out pretty quickly.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's pretty obvious. And it might even, I don't know if my copy is within arm's reach. It might even be on the back of the book. But the back of the book I have,
yes.
the
Oh,
back of
yeah.
the book I have
Oh,
is
yeah.
not the same that the back of the book other people have, right? Because we get those
Oh,
advanced
you
copies.
got the arc, yeah.
Yeah, so I
Yes,
have,
it does
if you
say
know
right
it.
on the back of the book that she encounters ghosts there. So
Yeah,
anybody who
yeah.
looks at the back of the book will know right away who she's talking to.
Well, yeah, it's interesting when you get those arcs because, like, I have an advanced reader copy of Jack Davis's The Gulf, which is a wonderful reference book, but it has no index. So
Oh.
it's very annoying. So I have these books, and I have to remember when I say, oh, yeah, go look at page whatever, that doesn't apply for anybody. My books are useless as references, but they're so much fun. And your book was, don't tell Jack, it was a lot more fun than his book. Does that
I'd
make me a bad
agree.
person?
No, it's like apples and oranges, you know, nonfiction and fiction. I want to ask, so did you have a kid this age that you wrote about? Because the
I did
dialogue is
at one
so good.
time.
Okay. So you
Yeah, I kind of wanted to write a kid's book for a while since my kids were young, but unfortunately did not get around to it till they were much older. Now they're both out of college. So they will read it, of course. But it's not their target group. It's not age group for the target audience.
Wait, I'm not your target audience?
Well, okay. Honestly, you know, I mean, I think it's adult friendly as well.
Yeah, I
I
agree.
like the idea of writing kids' books that are adult friendly. And, you know, I'm not talking down. I don't like to talk down to the kids either. So I think that helps.
Oh, no, it doesn't at all. I mean, I didn't notice it. I would have been annoyed by it. I thought it was wonderful, but I think some YA is really, I think YA has come a long way since I was the target audience for a YA reader. I think we've since the 1970s and 80s, I think we've accepted that tweens and teens can definitely handle heavier topics than we think they can.
And they know a whole lot more, you know, than we
Well,
did.
that's
We didn't have
true.
the internet, you know. We had PBS if we were lucky, and you know, it was staticky at best because we didn't have cable initially.
We had Zoom.
We
We
had
had Zoom.
Zoom, not the
electric
Zoom you're
company.
thinking about. We had Zoom and 321
The other
Contact.
Zoom,
Yes, the
the
other
OG
Zoom.
Zoom.
Go on.
Do you remember a show called Connections?
Yes.
James Burke.
Yes, late at night.
Do you remember that, John?
I don't think I saw
Oh,
that.
they're all online, I think. That had so much influence on me because he starts with something and ends with something and then fills in all the details in between. It's like, you know, this explosion that happened in 1647 led to this huge event in, you know, common time. And then he goes, you know, thing to thing to thing to thing to thing and how they're all interconnected. And that
When did
still
that
influences
air?
me. 70s,
It was on in the
80s,
90s and the early
90s.
2000s.
I don't know.
It was a
And
great
there's
show.
just a handful of them.
And now, of course, if you Google Connections, you get the friggin' New York Times game.
Oh.
Hold on. I'll find out the answer because our listeners desperately want it. It was a British TV series.
Yes. And so it may have been like BBC One or something like that. Or that other one. Anyways, that's.
It says that it only had 46 episodes. That can't possibly be
No,
true.
it wasn't very long, and I loved it. And I'm sorry to go down there, not talk about your book, but you know, one of the things I have thought about this dystopian future that you write about as a possibility for what happens with Florida, because what I worry about is we get multiple hurricanes and what multiple hurricanes, and that whole Citizens Insurance Group bankrupts the state with all the claims, and that. People can't insure their homes, so they just abandon the state.
Yeah.
I mean, do you think the scenario you create is all that, you know, could it really happen in your mind?
Yes. It was kind of an easy dystopia to write about,
yeah.
Especially because when I was finishing it up, we got those hurricanes, the double whammy here in Tampa Bay. But yes, I mean, hurricanes can get more frequent and they might get stronger. We're already seeing that. Strangely, though, it hasn't had a huge effect on the number of people coming to Florida. They keep piling in. And I don't know. And then we're doing ridiculous things like beach replenishment, you know, which is just like food for the next hurricane. So people keep coming and people keep buying waterfront property. I think it's going to take a lot more than those, you know, two hurricanes in a row to do that. But if they start happening, like, you know, eight hurricanes hit Florida a year, then people might think twice about coming to Florida.
Yeah.
Which is kind of what we've all been hoping for many years now.
I think, you know.
But if we have to live here, we don't want to get demolished by hurricanes.
I feel like I'm going to say something unpopular. Hurricanes are grossly misunderstood. And I feel like this is my sharks and gators argument. Hurricanes are not a problem unless there's something we've built there. Hurricanes are a natural part of the cycle. They're necessary. They're part of the fire cycle. They're part of the annual cycle. What my hope would be is that at some point we stop doubling down on our mistakes. So I have in Gulfport a tour that I developed that we're going to start giving this month, an environmental walking tour of Clam Bayou, which is a nature preserve right on the bay. And it's connected to the middle of St. Pete, and the lake that it's connected to, the source, also drains out into Tampa Bay the other way. And in this walking tour, I talk about how essentially most of this whole neighborhood was not land 100 years ago. And it's unfortunate, almost all of this neighborhood was also submerged in 2024. And I did a test one with a couple of people just to do one last test before we brought it live. And as I was driving out of the district, I'm driving and I see on this street where I was on that street, I was taking pictures for the paper. I know how high the water was on every single one of those houses. One house is elevated. The rest of them have basically just gone back to business as usual. And I thought, you know, man, at what point do we listen? Is it going to take citizens failing? Is it going to take the financial bottom to fall out? Like, it's nobody's fault that they bought somewhere that they didn't know had been dredged, that they don't know the environmental history. But I feel like when something that occurs naturally sends you a warning of that magnitude, at what point do we as humans go, huh, maybe this wasn't the greatest idea? And that's what kind of scares me a little bit, is like Douglas Adams, the science fiction writer, had this wonderful quote, and it said something like, human beings are unique in their ability to learn from their mistakes and also their disinclination to do so. Mm-hmm. And I think about that a lot. Like, that was a big warning sign, 2024. And the insurance companies all paid. Some people are still struggling with FEMA, but by and large, people have been allowed to return to business as usual. And that scares me a little bit, because is it going to take deaths? Is it going to take people losing their homes again and nobody rebuilding it for them with insurance? What's our stop point as a society? What's the point where we say, okay, do not pass? This is enough. When do we tap out?
It's a good question. The money is a disincentive to change. I mean, if they're private firms are buying up these beach houses on the cheap after hurricanes, fixing them up and reselling them without putting them on stilts or anything like that, and people keep buying them, then the money's there, and they, you know, they've got their fingers in the state government to keep things the way they want, to keep the money flowing in, to keep the regulations flowing out. So I think it's going to take a lot, unfortunately, to change.
Well,
a lot of hurricanes.
I'm 38 feet above sea level, so I feel pretty comfortable. But have you ever seen or heard about or read about these towns where they flood a town, and underneath the water, the whole town is basically still there.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Seen images of that.
That's where they build a dam and something, and when the dam comes down, there's the town.
Mm-hmm. I'm picturing underwater archaeologists in, I don't know, 500 years, 1,000 years, if we're still on this planet. Scuba diving expeditions along the Gulf Coast of Florida and seeing these towns that are submerged. I mean, I don't know. Maybe that's too dystopian for YA, but it is pretty cool. Sorry.
Yeah, well,
I got dark real quick there.
Maybe that'll be the sequel.
Yeah. Are you going to do another one? I mean, these characters have legs.
I hope there's more.
I left that open at the end. I mean, she did make her mom promise that they would come back so she could visit her ghost friends at the beach. And her mom's got this business. She started making shell jewelry to sell on Etsy. So she has to replenish her shells. So they could come back. I don't know what the issue will be for them. Maybe the monsters will still be there and they'll keep coming back.
Can I say the shell thing was one of my favorite parts of the book? Because when I was in fourth grade, we had a magical vacation on Sanibel Island and got up every morning and looked for shells. And I think there's jars of shells around, that was, like 50 years ago. And I think there's still jars of shells around our house from that trip. And I could just recapture those moments through what you wrote about, because I mean that there's a positive side to all those storms. They're bringing up all those shells that you might not get to see, which I really love that detail.
Thanks. Yeah, we've still got jars of shells from Sanibel Island too, where we took the kids there. Yeah, that was inspired by Sanibel Island.
I am staring at a lamp that is filled with some of my shells right now. And it's not from the 70s. I bought it maybe 15 years ago and filled it with my shells.
Nice.
But I digression. Do you know I found a little octopus on Sanibel?
Really?
Yeah. So,
Living? Sanibel,
yeah. So Sanibel Island, the way it's situated, for those of you who aren't sure where we're talking about, it is perpendicular to the Gulf Coast of Florida. So it has a lot more wave action than most of our Gulf coastal beaches. And it gets a lot of really interesting shells. My cousin was down on vacation and I saw a little tiny dwarf octopus and I, let it go. It was like in a shell that I picked up and it crawled out of the shell and I'm like, oh, cool. And I put it back in the water. Well, I had a saltwater tank. And I had a big 55-gallon saltwater tank, and it was all water from the Gulf that I would get from being out on boats. And I said, man, I wish I hadn't taken him back. I wish I hadn't put him back. I'd love to have him in my tank. And we're walking along the beach, and all of a sudden, I see another one walking down the beach. I mean, it was because what happens is they get washed up in the shells, but they can't live. They need salt water. So they'll crawl out of the shells and they'll just take their little 8 tentacles and clamber on back into the Gulf. And it was the coolest thing.
Awesome.
Yeah, I actually, believe it or not, we had a water bottle in the car. I drank the water, filled it up with salt water, put him in there, and he lived a happy, healthy life in my saltwater tank. It's great.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, anyway, total aside, I think in your next book that she should find an octopus.
Well, there are sea serpents in the book, and there's something that lives in the pool that is very scary.
Yeah, what is in the pool? Can you shed some light on that?
So, I don't know. This is definitely a spoiler if I talk about this.
No, yeah, don't do it.
Don't,
but
there's
tentacles on the book cover down at the bottom, which I love the cover art. It's a beautiful illustration and fun typography, too. It's nice.
Thank you. Thank you. They did a great job with it. I think the explanation for the pool creature comes at the climax.
Okay.
We won't talk about it.
Okay. Have to reread that.
Okay.
It
might be easy to pass over that, but there's an explanation, in that climax.
Okay.
That tells why she was seeing things in the pool.
Okay. What are you working on now?
I just sort of finished another middle grade novel that I'm starting to shop around. And then I got back to a adult novel that I started like 15, 20 years ago. Set it aside to work on something else, then rediscovered it a year ago or so. I'm like, oh, this is almost done. But of course, it wasn't almost done. But I am working on that now. And that concerns, it's kind of a, I'm thinking of it as a David Lynch Does Elvis book. It takes place in 1961 when Elvis was in Florida filming Follow That Dream. And so there are some supernatural things going on there, and it's kind of a multi-character look at, you know, Elvis's point of view is in there. There's like a town sheriff. There's a mermaid. And there's some carnival workers, like retired circus people. And some strange things happen in this small town that's near where Elvis was making the movie.
Which is Citrus County, right?
Yes. I made up some names of towns, so it's not exactly the same. But it's the whole kind of Yankee Town, Inverness area.
I love driving US 19 because when you drive past Yankee Town and you go, I think it's 40, underneath the street sign, it's Follow That Dream Parkway, which is the Elvis movie.
Yes, and if you take that out to the beach there, you know, you go through Yankee Town and then it keeps going, and then you go over this bridge. It's the Bird Creek Bridge, and that's where they filmed. I don't know, have you ever seen that movie, Follow That Dream?
Oh yeah,
it's been a long time.
Yeah. Well, it's this it's based on a book, but it's Elvis is part of this family that comes down to Florida, and they have car trouble, and they decide to just homestead on the beach.
As one does.
And so the locals don't take kindly to that, especially the there are some local gangsters that do, because they realize, if they can just kind of set up and do their own thing here outside the law, we're going to have a gambling operation here. So anyway, like Elvis and his family play these kind of they're like Beverly Hillbillies coming to Florida to set up shop. So like where they set up is a man-made beach specifically for this movie that's right next to that bridge that still exists. And I went up there and took pictures when I was initially researching this novel, and they just brought in truckloads of sand and like poured it out and made a beach next to the bridge. And then they brought in palm trees, stuck them in the ground, and the palm trees died right away. So they spray painted the brown leaves green for the movie, and they just kept doing their thing. And now it's all grown over.
So my favorite scene from that movie is Elvis is fishing, and he's got a cane pole. Like, there's no reel, it's just the rod, and he lands a tarpon.
Yes.
And it's just, it's really just a beautiful moment of cinematic ignorance. Like, but
he's so good. He's such a good fisherman.
He's so good. And the tarpon
Elvis
just
could
willingly,
do it.
Yeah, just gave
you
up.
Know, not the average person, but Elvis, he just attracted the fish.
Yeah.
He's good.
Well, that's part of their thing too, because they start like catering to local or tourists, fishermen who come there, and Elvis is like, I'll help you catch tarpons off this bridge with cane poles or whatever you want. So everybody comes, they catch whatever fish they want. It's the magical Elvis.
I feel like there's a lot of suspend disbelief happening with this movie. You know, I know you know this, John. I don't know if you know this, Rick. Do you know the short story that, or the book or whatever it was named, I was called Pioneer Go Home. But do you know what state it was written about? No? Mm. New Jersey.
Yeah.
New Jersey.
Yeah, I read that book as I was researching for the novel too.
Oh,
yeah,
so
it's a pretty good book. It's pretty funny. The family is from New Jersey. I'm not sure where the beach is supposed to be.
Must have been the Jersey Shore before.
It could have been the Jersey Shore. I'm not sure that they're
Kiki
actually
or Snuffy or whatever her name was.
Yeah,
what was the? I don't watch enough.
Snooki.
Snooki. Thanks for
Lucky.
holding up the side there, Rick.
Actually, you know, the beach in Jersey is actually pretty nice. I went up there for a conference in Wildwood, and, you know, it's just a great beach. You know, I wouldn't want to be there in December, but, you know, it's like Daytona or something. It's really weird because for some reason where I was, they had built a jetty, and instead of, you know, we do beach renourishment here, the beach kept growing. So it was at least a quarter mile from the hotel to the edge of the water because the beach was had, you know, it just piled up the sand on the other side of this jetty. And I was thinking, why don't they do that in Florida? Because we waste, you know, we've done beach renourishment shows and we don't want to go down that rabbit hole today.
I'm prepared to go down that rabbit
hole.
It'd be more depressing than hurricanes.
No, we've done hurricanes. That's enough for our listeners today. And we want to celebrate John's book because it's a huge accomplishment. Have you published before? What else have you written in the past?
Well, this is the first book for kids.
Right.
But then I've written novels and story collections for adults. So my first novel was The Legend of the Barefoot Mailman, which is another Florida legend. Mm-hmm. That was published back in 96.
That's right. Uh-huh. I have that book.
Oh, thank you.
Yes. Well, you've been on the podcast before, pre-Rick.
Right.
I came on
to talk about Fearsome Creatures of Florida. You had me on to talk about that, which was like a collection of cryptozoological fake Florida creatures, some fake, some not
fake. They just haven't been discovered yet.
Right. They are real in the book. And if you haven't found them, that's
fault. On you, really. You're just not trying.
Yeah.
So we have The Legend of the Barefoot Mailman, Fearsome Creatures of Florida. I want to say I had a Kindle. I don't know if I had the Kindle or the Apple books, but isn't there one of them that's animated if you...
Yes, and I'm a little salty about that because
should I not mention?
I worked with the publisher who thought it was a great idea. I had this idea to make an animated version because I have a local friend of mine who did animations, took the drawings in the book and made animations out of them. And then I've been to a lot of schools. I mean, the book is not really for kids. Though, because they're illustrations, sometimes parents think it is, and then it's a little too dark in places for kids, I think. But anyway, I've talked to some school groups and showed them these animations and, you know, read them some that are more appropriate for them from the book. But then I'm like, well, why don't we just publish an ebook with these animations? Well, it's not that easy. There was a way I had to do a lot of research. I put a lot into it to try to create this book that when you download it, it shows at the beginning of each chapter a little frame with the creature, and you click on the creature or a little video camera, and it pops up on the screen and shows you that animation. So you get to see the animation, and then you get to read about that creature. But it never worked on Kindle because Kindle doesn't play animation. So you had to download it to a desktop or a tablet that would play these animations. But I think something has happened where even that is not working now. It's sad because I put so much into it and it was such a cool thing that I wish Amazon would make Kindles that would play animations because I think people would enjoy it.
Does it work if they buy it on Apple Books or is it not available there?
It's not available there now because I think somehow I had to do working through like KDP on Amazon. I had to use proprietary stuff to make it work at all.
Well, I'm sorry to... Sorry to bring up. You sent me the Fearsome Creature of Florida playing cards, and I still have those.
Oh,
they're
yes.
They're in the RV, yep. So if I need to play solitaire without my phone or computer, I am all set in the RV.
You've talked about them before.
I really like them. I love the book, but I like cryptids. I mean, I really want to get somebody on here to talk about the skunk ape again.
I just read or I listened to the audiobook of Dave Barry's Swamp Story. I don't know if you've seen that.
It's an old one, isn't it?
I think that I'm thinking that one's pretty new.
Is that the one where they have
It's about a fake cryptid.
a fake cryptid?
Yeah, these guys get this idea to,
Yes,
because
I
they know
laughed my
about the
ass off
skunk
at that
ape,
book.
so they're gonna like put on a Dora the Explorer head and walk through the swamp and get someone to take pictures, video of it, and then it goes viral. And then, but there's also buried gold out there and
And the federal government's
madcap
down
stuff.
there. I remember this book. Yes, I laughed my ass off. Like first chapter, I couldn't stop laughing. Like laugh out loud, good. Highly recommend. Guys, you got to go to the
Very
show notes
funny.
and buy all the books that I've listed as we've been talking.
The other books I've written are the I published my short story collection, Songs for the Deaf. That was with Borough Press out of Orlando. That kind of collected stories I've been writing and publishing in literary magazines over 20 years or so. And then I did another thing called The Book I Will Write that started as a blog. And I can't write nonfiction, so I started like a nonfiction blog that immediately turned into fiction. And it was about an author who's trying to write a book and like approaches an editor at Knopf and talks wants them to accept his book just on his idea and talking
Will they
about
do
it in
that?
these
Can
letters.
I get can I
No,
get
they will
one?
not do that. They will not even open your emails if you do that. Unless it's nonfiction and or if you're, Stephen King, whatever.
Yeah, well.
Then you get anything published. But so the whole thing is an email exchange between this writer and the editor and the editorial assistant, and then these other people get involved, including like a weird group that wants to bring Zeppelins back into prominence in the United States, but they need somebody to write to the FAA to support this project. So they kidnap him and force him in a warehouse to write letters to the FAA for them. So his like his then he's under threat. Someone wants to kill him at some point. So it's like this crazy writerly adventure that I, and the thing with that book is I started on a blog and then I got a publisher, Atticus Books, which unfortunately doesn't exist anymore, but they agreed to publish it piecemeal on their website. And so I did it sort of as blog posts on Atticus Books website, and I invited feedback to influence the plot.
Wow.
So I would publish, one or two per week of these emails and then solicit comments from people. It was an interesting experience because I was kind of writing the book in real time and I didn't know where it was going to end up. So I got some comments from writers. I had to think about it a lot. I had to get myself out of some plot jams. But because it was supposed to be funny, I could do ridiculous things to get out of those plot jams, which made it easier. So it finally wrapped up pretty well, I think. And then I just turned it into a novel and put it on Amazon.
So, wow. Okay. I haven't read that one. Now I have to read it. Let me ask you before we go and before we thank all our paid listeners, do you have a favorite cryptid?
A real cryptid?
I'm sorry. I don't know how to
Oh,
answer that.
you walked right into that.
You mean a real cryptid, but I repeat myself. So I would gently remind you that people would say that the skunk ape is not real, but the coelacanth is. The narwhal is.
Coelacanth, yeah.
Coelacanth. So I'm not going to even say a real. I'm going to assume all cryptids are real until someone proves to me they aren't. No, do you have a favorite cryptid? It can be
Well,
anyone you want.
I think I gotta go with the skunk ape because there's a lot of skunk ape lore. It's our little version of Bigfoot. When I was a kid, I loved the Bigfoot stories and I still do. And then discovered we had our own Bigfoot in Florida. And I love the fact that it's known most of all for its stench.
Well,
So
technically, we have three
a thing.
cryptids in Florida. We have
So
three skunk. Bigfoot's in Florida.
There's one, the Barden Booger.
Barden Booger, yeah.
And what's the Two-Egg Stump Jumper.
Where's that?
Two-Egg.
Two-Egg.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. And I thought it was the only Bigfoot on the planet that was a little person, but apparently the Bigfoot in Hawaii, Menehune, I think is how you pronounce it, is also a little person. Yeah, but big
I
feet.
Think Bigfoot would be the proper term.
Either that or they're hobbits.
The feet are big. The stature is miniature.
It's a hobbit. That's a hobbit.
Okay, but there's another non-Florida cryptid that I love too called the Squonk. Do you know what the Squonk
is?
No,
where's the Squonk?
Oh. Okay, so there's this book published in 1910 that was the inspiration for Fearsome Creatures of Florida. It's called Fearsome Creatures of the Lumberwoods. And beautiful illustrations in that book, and it collects mostly wood stories from the north, like lumberjack reports of cryptids. And one of these, I think it is supposed to be in Pennsylvania, it's called the Squonk. And little known fact, it's in a Steely Dan song. Any major dude has a reference to the Squonk. And the Squonk is an animal that's so ugly that if you see it, it melts away in tears because it can't stand anybody to look at him.
Aww.
Isn't that so sad?
This is why we should not make fun of people's appearances. Look at what a horrible thing that does.
Right. That's what it speaks to, I think. And it's just like,
I'm really trying to remember the lyrics. The demons are at your door or something.
I'll tell you what it is. It's something like, have you ever seen a squonk's tears? Well, look at mine.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So you wouldn't even know that that's the word he's singing.
No.
Unless you looked it up. Or knew about squonks.
Jesus. In Florida, obviously my favorite cryptid is the skunk ape. Rick?
I'm not a big cryptid fan as you are.
He's scoffing at the cryptids.
I was into it when I was a kid. What were those movies you used to see? That guy, he made all the movies about the pyramids and UFOs and Bigfoot.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I used to be way into that stuff.
Me too.
And, something of the gods.
Oh, Chariots of the Gods.
Chariots of the Gods. Yes. I love those books. I loved it. And I just kind of moved on. So So I'll say Bigfoot. I mean, Skunk Ape just to play.
Okay. So. Well, it's settled then.
Sorry.
It's settled. It's unanimous.
I like Bart and Booger because that's a great name, too.
Mm-hmm. It feels gross.
It's got nice alliteration. Yeah.
I guess. Yeah. Anyway. Time has come in our podcast where we want to definitely thank our active supporters, the people who send us money every month to support our mythical t-shirt habit. In no particular order, we want to thank Nicole Amrose, Sean Coulter, Kelly Sturdy, Stephanie Hewley, Brad Sager, Brian Woodall, Bet's Boys Adventure, who I know we're going to go out and buy this book, Elise Smith, Carol Miller, Davita Breyer, Natalie Zacharick, Angela Connolly, and Ryan Worthington. It's super, super easy to support the podcast. Just go to floridaspectacular.buzzsprout.com and click support. And you can support us for as little as $3 a month. Makes a big difference to us. You probably won't notice the money missing. But if you worry about a world without Kathy and Rick discussing Elvis movies about Florida and fearsome creatures and Steely Dan, worry no longer. Just support the podcast. And we're here to stay.
I my slogan for my t-shirt this week is going to be, I picked the Bargain Booger.
There has to be a showdown, Skunk Ape versus Barden Booger. Like those
like
classic Godzilla versus King Kong movies. You know, we need to see that film.
Who's the guy, the Rat Fink guy, you know, that illustrator who did Rat Fink? He could do a great illustration.
Chuck Jones?
Maybe. No, I think that's I don't know who that guy is. I don't know. I can see this great illustration though. Mm-hmm. Boy. Maybe I'll do an AI version, but that's a whole other show.
Somebody get on that t-shirt. I would buy it.
Yeah. Yeah. Good idea. All right.
All right. Well, on that note, John, thank you. You are always a delightful guest. Rick, it is a pleasure to digitally see you. Sounds bad.
See you in person in a couple of weeks.
In person.
Thank you both for having me.
Thanks, John. And
good luck on the book.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I hope it sells well and you write another one. And real quick, if you saw me at Tiki Agogo, thanks for coming up to the table and telling me how much you loved our podcast. And if you are listening to this in real time, meaning if you are listening to it April 8th or later 2026, you have the chance to see Rick and I in person taping our podcast live Saturday, April 11th. At USF St. Pete. We are going to be doing a live version of the podcast where you'll be able to ask us questions. We have no idea how that's going to go, but it will be fun. That's all we have. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time on Florida Spectacular.